So, how many of you remember the comic strip, Hager the Horrible? Does anybody remember that? That actually, I found out during the week, it's syndicated all over the United States. We just no longer get it in the St. Louis Post. So if you're visiting, you might pick it up. Well, I heard about one of the strips that I thought was great for us to look at today. And in it, Hager is praying. And he prays to God and he says, God, I can't see you. Why don't you show yourself to me? How can I believe you are real if I cannot see you? And at that moment, right beside Hager, a flower breaks through the concrete right where he's standing. And then he looks in the distance and a volcano is erupting. There is an eclipse that turns the sky completely dark. And then there is a shooting star through the stratosphere. Next, there is a huge tidal wave that washes over him and just drenches him completely. Then there is the beginning of a burning bush. And finally, a stone is rolled away from a cave. And Hager gets up from his knees. It's dark and he's soaked from the tidal wave, full of mud. And he says, God, I don't understand it. Every single time I ask you this question, all I get is another interruption. Well, Hager has something in common, actually, with those who first met Jesus after the resurrection. Because as we've said the last couple of weeks, just as Hager has trouble seeing God, those to whom Jesus first appeared have trouble recognizing that he is the risen Christ. And the pattern continues in the story that we're going to look at today. This story occurs shortly after the one we looked at last week, where Jesus appears to the disciples in the upper room. So it turns out that during that event, one disciple was missing. He was not present. You all know who he is? Who is it was missing? Thomas. That's exactly right. So the other disciples tell him all about it. They probably tell him again and again. They say to him, we have seen the Lord. But he says to them, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. And so we're going to pick that story up in John chapter 20, verse 26. And it begins, a week later, the disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them this time and stood among them. The doors were actually shut, locked, but Jesus came and stood right there and said to them again, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe. Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. Jesus said to him, have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. So we all know what nickname Thomas earns from this event. It is what? Doubting Thomas. That's exactly right. Now, certainly in the story, Thomas does refuse to believe until he sees Jesus with his own outer eyes, doesn't he? But here's the question. Did Mary Magdalene believe Jesus was resurrected until she heard her name called? No. Not at all. Did John and Peter, who got to the tomb first and looked in, did they believe in the resurrection at that point? No. And did the disciples, that last story we looked at, who were gathered in the upper room, did they believe it was Jesus until they saw his scars? No. And yet we call none of them doubting, do we? Maybe we need to relook at Thomas's name here. Because in the end, Thomas does have faith. When he receives the... Well, actually, I need to back up a little bit. Thomas represents, we kind of have to ask ourselves, what can we learn from Thomas? Because we know that every single Bible character represents some aspect of ourselves, some spiritual power. And Thomas represents the power of understanding. Metaphysically, That falls into two groups. There is intellectual understanding. That's the kind of understanding based on evidence where we can reason and think through it. It's really based on what we see and what we take in with our senses. It's based on our worldly experiences. And the second kind is spiritual understanding. That's the kind that just wells up within us in terms of inspiration and intuition. And the thing is that intellectual understanding is great. It serves us well, does it not? But it never, ever gives us the whole picture. Charles Fillmore said, "The intellect is not wise. Wisdom is not its office." And the other type of understanding, the spiritual understanding, does give us the whole picture. So, why do you think Thomas is not there when all the disciples meet? Surely he knew that they were all meeting right after the resurrection. Well, some Bible scholars believe that Thomas was a little more pessimistic than the others, and that he maybe was more worried and more frightened for his life. Or maybe he was in shock, so disillusioned that he couldn't muster the strength to have dinner with his fellow disciples. Now, while all that could be true, I think more importantly, his absence shows something else, and that is the intellect is never the first to behold the Christ. In fact, spiritual truths must be discerned spiritually. They must come from within. And when we think about it, when Thomas receives his proof, he has that flash of spiritual understanding. And he says, "My Lord, my God." This has been called the greatest declaration of faith in the entire Bible. And Dr. Herbert Hunt, who was a former dean of Bible studies at Unity School of Christianity, Dr. Hunt reminds us that Thomas not only accepts the truth of the resurrection, but he openly proclaims the divinity of Jesus Christ. And at that time, such a statement could have brought on the charge of blasphemy, and that charge was punishable by death under the Roman law. And remember Jesus' response to him? Jesus says, "Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed," simply meaning, "Thomas, Thomas, there was a faster way. You didn't have to go through all the fear and the grief if you had relied on your spiritual insight instead of your outer eyesight." Because it is that spiritual insight is a deep inner knowing. And as Reverend Red Rabel notes, just as Jesus had earlier transcended the old Mosaic law of an eye for an eye, so now he transcends the old idea that seeing is believing. Jesus is telling Thomas, the other disciples, and us that believing is seeing. It's the other way around. That when we look beyond outer appearances to a deep inner knowing, we understand things of the spirit and things of the physical perspective. We are doubly blessed because Thomas is a twin. His name, Thomas Didymus. Thomas means in Hebrew twin, and Didymus means in Greek twin. And so that's the double blessing that Thomas gives us. Now, according to the Gospel of John, Jesus' next appearance happens in the northern part of Israel at the Sea of Galilee, where the seven of the disciples are gathered. Now, I think we've talked before that the Sea of Galilee is not really a sea at all. It is a freshwater lake. It's the largest freshwater lake in Israel, and it is the place where Jesus spent so much of his ministry along the shores of Galilee. So the seven are gathered together in Galilee when Peter suddenly announces to the group, "I'm going fishing." And the other six reply, "Okay, we'll go with you." So they go out, get in the boat, and fish all night long. But they do not catch one single fish. We're going to pick the story up in the next chapter of John, chapter 21, verse 4. Now, many scholars do believe that this is a part that was added later to the Gospels. This was not written at the same time as the rest of the John was written. Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but his disciples did not know it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" And they answered, "No." And he said to them, "Well, cast the net to the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not even able to haul in the net. It was so full of fish. And then John, who represents love, says to Peter, "It is the Lord on the shore." And when Simon Peter hears this, he puts on some clothes, for the text says that he was naked. Actually, he would have been wearing a tunic, and he would have been bare from the waist up, because that's how the Galilean fishermen fished. But at any rate, the text says naked, and jumped into the sea. But the other disciples came in with the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards away. When they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And though there were so many, the net was not broken. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now they knew and recognized that it was the Lord. And Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. Now this was the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So, from Matthew, Mark, and John, three of the four Gospels, we learn that the disciples are in Galilee according to Jesus' instruction, specific instruction. In Matthew 28:7, the angel tells the women gathered at the tomb, he says to them, "Go quickly and tell the disciples to go to Galilee. Jesus will meet them there." Now, considering this, considering that he had specific instructions, Peter did, to go to Galilee, why does he decide to go fishing instead? That's an important question for us to ask ourselves. Why doesn't he wait as he was supposed to wait for Jesus? Was he bored and tired of waiting day after day with no sign of Jesus? It would have been about a 3-day trip from Jerusalem to Galilee. Maybe he thought Jesus wasn't coming. Maybe he and the others had experienced ridicule after the crucifixion because their master was believed to be gone, and maybe he just needed an escape. Or maybe as Peter watches that familiar scene of the boat sailing out from the harbor, maybe nostalgia just sets in and suddenly he just says, "I'm going fishing." Remember, Peter always is the impetuous disciple. But there's another possibility, one that gives the story really deeper meaning. Certainly the death of Jesus had thrown the lives of all the disciples into confusion and chaos. Perhaps Peter is so discouraged and unsure about the future that in despair he turns back to his old way of life, to the kind of fishing, the comfort of doing what he knew how to do, fishing for fish, not as Jesus had called him to become a fisher of men. Surely that was going to be harder. And the others follow Peter right out into the sea to the familiar sounds and smells of being on the lake in the moonlight, hoisting the sails, feeling the familiar ropes in their hands, focusing only on the fishing nets floating in the sea. Now, while going fishing might have seemed like a great idea to Peter and the crew, it certainly was not what Jesus had told them a week ago. Remember in John 20, Jesus tells them, "As the Father has sent me, so I send you." Remember that from last week? And I have a feeling that Jesus was not sending them back to fishing. That wasn't the idea. And just think, on a more serious note, what it would have meant to Christianity if the disciples had permanently returned to their old jobs. So here they are out in the sea all night long, and they do not catch any fish, not one. Now remember, Andrew, Peter, James, and John, 4 of the 7, were seasoned fishermen. They had been fishing on the Sea of Galilee since they were boys. They knew that sea and where the fish were like the back of their hands. How is it possible that they could fish all night long and not even find enough fish for breakfast? Exhausted and hungry, nets empty, hands empty, hearts empty, they see a man standing on the shore. but they do not recognize him as Jesus. Now, we might wonder about that also. The text said they were only about 100 yards from the shore. Well, maybe it was foggy. It does get foggy around the Sea of Galilee. That's a possibility. Or maybe they were just too upset and exhausted from their fishing failure to be focused on Jesus. At any rate, Jesus addresses the disciples as children and says, in effect, to them, "Catch any fish, boys?" And he knows very well that they have not. This seems kind of like that old Dr. Phil question. How's this fishing trip working out for you, right? How's this working out for you, guys? And then Jesus, still unrecognized, tells them to cast to the right side of the boat. They do so, and obviously we know they have so many fish they can hardly drag them in. Because the disciples so readily follow what they perceive to be a stranger's advice, maybe something deep inside of them recognizes their master, sort of subconsciously, before they become fully conscious of his identity, because they do what he says, which is remarkable, actually. Maybe the message for us is, just like the one in the story of Mary Magdalene and the two men on the road to Emmaus, that the Christ is always available, but sometimes we are not receptive. Another message, I think, from this story is, once you understand your true purpose, it is really hard to go back to your old way of life, almost impossible. So we need to talk a little bit about what is the significance of the right side of the boat. Of course, it's possible that Jesus, standing on the shore, maybe saw a shoal of fish on the right side, and he was directing them to something he had seen. But biblical scholars insist he doesn't say the other side of the boat. He says the right side of the boat. And here's the thing. Galilean fishermen always fished on the left side. That's the way their boats were equipped. These disciples would have learned that from their fathers and their fathers' fathers, and every fisherman in Galilee would have fished from the left side of the boat for centuries. So that was all they would have known. I mean, to turn around and fish on the other side would be really foreign to them. So it seems to me that Jesus is reminding the disciples and us that when we are able to turn away from what the world tells us is right and turn within to the guidance of the indwelling Christ, unimaginable blessings flow. When we turn away from those old ingrained habits and thinking to the right or spiritual side of our being, to the oneness of our indwelling Christ, we always access a greater truth, a truth that we did not see before. Metaphysically, the Sea of Galilee, actually the Sea of Tiberias, means spiritual insight, discernment, and good vision. And in Scripture, fish always represent ideas of increase. So really, this story seems to be about choice, about our choice. We can work, stress, and strain in the dark doubt of night without the illumination of spiritual understanding, and probably we will catch no fish, no productive ideas. Anybody ever been there? Stress and strain and worry and all of that. Even if we catch a few fish, we end up being exhausted, don't we? It doesn't seem worth the effort. Or in faith, we can cast our nets on the side of what is spiritually true. We can turn our pivotal souls away from any appearance of conflict or lack and know that we are one with a power greater than anything in this world. Living from the Christ of our being, the right side, our nets are filled with divine ideas, and all the love, power, and wisdom we need are ours. And remember, when the disciples look up, they see that Jesus is cooking breakfast over a charcoal fire, ready to feed their human hunger, just as he has so many times fed their hearts and souls. Now, that charcoal fire is really significant because that term is used only twice in the Bible. The only other time the word charcoal fire is present is when Peter sat around a charcoal fire as he was denying Jesus denying knowing Jesus. So when Peter sees that fire, surely it must trigger in him feelings of regret and guilt. For this story, in the end, really is all about Peter, the first disciple called. Peter represents the power of faith, that very foundation for building spiritual consciousness. And the writer of Hebrews says, and we all know this beautiful spiritual verse, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Doesn't that tie into the story of Thomas? In other words, it is faith that enables us to look past the appearances of lack, to perceive and believe in divine ideas, even when we don't see anything in the outer world. And most of us, if we're honest, that faith doesn't develop overnight, does it? It takes some time for us to discover it, develop it, and allow it to express. Like Peter, our faith sometimes falters anytime we believe that outer appearances are the ultimate reality. And so our story continues when, after breakfast, Jesus singles Peter out for what we might call a private session, asking him not once, not twice, but three times a deep and profound question. And the question is, do you love me? The Amplified Bible adds, with intention, with spiritual devotion, do you really love me above all the things in this outer world? And the third and final time, Jesus says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him three times. And he said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, then feed my sheep. The compelling question, repeated three times, reminds us, as I'm sure it reminded Peter, of the three times that he had denied Jesus before the crucifixion. Yet the repeated question coming from Jesus doesn't sound punitive at all. Anything but. He addresses Peter by the name he used the first time Peter was called, Simon, son of John, as if Jesus were bringing Peter back to the beginning, erasing his times of faltered faith. It sounds like Jesus is not trying to make Peter feel guilty or bad, but Jesus is calling Peter to a renewal of faith, a second chance to choose who he will serve, a new opportunity to approach life on the right side. And Reverend Ed Townley says, in this moment, Jesus is giving Peter the chance to dissolve all the negative energy of shame and regret that he might still be holding about having denied Jesus. And in Peter's passionate cry, three times of, Yes, Lord, he is answering Jesus' call to serve. And that's what feed my sheep means. Love without service is not love. And so the past is over. Peter shows us that we can turn always, it's never too late, to turn to the fulfillment of future possibilities. And John's gospel actually ends shortly after this conversation. Now, there are other sightings of Jesus in the Bible after the resurrection. I don't want you to get the idea we've covered them all in the last few weeks. In Paul says in 1 Corinthians that Jesus appeared to 500 people at once. And so we need to ask ourselves, why does Jesus come back after the resurrection in a physical body form? And I believe it's a testimony to something he had taught all along, that we are spiritual beings and that our life is eternal. Death is an illusion. As James Dillett Freeman so beautifully writes in his poem, The Traveler, our life did not begin with birth. It is not of this earth. As eternal spiritual beings, life never ends. Resurrection always follows crucifixion, Jesus and our own. Paul wrote to the Romans, the Spirit of God that raised Jesus from the dead lives in you. That Spirit is the essence of our being. That Spirit is the essence of the being of every single one of us. We don't just in unity worship and believe in Jesus, but we believe what Jesus said. And he said, you are the light of the world, and the kingdom of God is within you. And no doubt, absolutely no doubt, resurrection occurs for us every single time we realize the perpetual indwelling life that makes us one with the divine. Every single time we are lifted up. And so it is. So let's just take a moment now to turn to the right side of our being where we know the truth about God. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this affirmation is printed in your bulletin. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.